had a chance to talk with Ralph a little bit about how class went. And I also wanted you all to know that I got a harassing text message after class Wednesday night from someone complaining about the Oxgo joke, about the people getting the point. To protect the name of the person who harassed me, I'll just refer to him as Reagan Haley. But in any event, it's bad enough to be harassed in person, but when they're just harassing me, even when I'm far away, that's just almost unconscionable. But in any event, Ralph couldn't be here this morning, and I'm glad because I want to brag on him, and it would really embarrass him if I did this when he was here. But first of all, if you've never taught a Bible class, you don't understand how much of a challenge it is when you're trying to think about how to communicate your thoughts, get them across to the class in a way that they can understand, and also keep track of where you are. On top of that, to step in and teach somebody else's class, because you're having to try to work your way into their flow of how they've got laid things out, is unbelievably difficult. And Ralph has just stepped right up to the plate and knocked it right out of there. And for those of you that I refer to as the old-timers, for those of you who have been members at Valrico, since way back in the days of the old building, you know what great growth you have seen in Ralph over the years. Some of you will remember times when he tried to get up and teach, and it just didn't go well. And to see him grow and to grow in knowledge and to grow in ability has just truly been wonderful. And he is such a great asset to our congregation in so many ways. And I really hope, if you haven't already, that you will make a point when you see Ralph again to thank him for all of the hard work that he puts into class. I give him, like when he's going to teach with me, I give him like 2 pages of notes. Then he gets up here and he's got like 27 pages of notes that he's worked on to expand, to be prepared. So, Sandy, don't you tell him that I said all this morning, okay? But I wanted you all to be sure you understood, if you're newer to this congregation, what great growth you've seen. And he should be an encouragement to anybody here. If you've been a Christian for a long time and you've never taught, and those words in Hebrews 5, when for the time you ought to be teachers, kind of zip into your conscience periodically, look at the example of Ralph and how he's grown and how he's developed. And that's something that's a possibility for more than just simply Ralph. So I just wanted to brag on my brother a little bit as we get started today. So I understand that you all got up to write about the story of Gideon, and that brings to mind an important point about studying the Old Testament in general and the book of Judges in particular. I have to say that even after having preached for, you know, quite some time, that in a lot of ways the default setting of my mind for characters in the Old Testament is sort of like, I had this Bible story book that my aunt and uncle gave to me. I think it was called the Richards Bible Story Book. It had, you know, pretty colorful pictures in it. And it basically paints the rosiest picture of all characters in the Bible. All the bad stuff is just, it's not in there. It's pretty much the rosiest spin you could put on any Bible characters. And that's still sort of like the default setting I have. But when you actually like look closely at the biblical text itself, you realize, as life usually is, that reality is much more complicated than that. And that is particularly true of these people here in the book of Judges. So you all have seen this chart a couple of times already. By the way, the Hagelwoods' older daughter, Maria, is the one who created this. It's one of the best visual aids I've ever seen for the book of Judges. In part because it shows us that as the cycle of the Judges continues through the book, things go from bad to worse for the people of Israel, and that is reflected in the lives of the judges. Which means, just as we go through the book, we should sort of have as a basic understanding that as we go from one judge to the next, that these judges are going to demonstrate a significant spiritual decline in keeping with the people of Israel themselves. So you'll notice that the story of Gideon is sort of midway through this sequence of judges. So I think a lot of us are familiar with the story of Gideon in Judges chapter 7, his hesitancy to serve the purpose of God, the various signs that God gave him, the dramatic victory over the Midianites when they whittled down their forces. If you're not super familiar with that story, you can go back to the 2020 website, the YouTube account for the church. This was one of the little kids' classes that I taught during the pandemic. And I will confess to you, I only taught chapter 7, because that's the good side of Gideon. I didn't teach the kids chapter 8. But now it's time for grown-up Bible story time. And so now we got to go in here to chapter 8. So I jokingly told Ralph that my old teacher, Phil Roberts, called Judges the wild, wild west of Israel's history. So in keeping with that theme, the judges are the good, the bad, and the ugly. All right? And it's pretty much over with the good after the first couple. Othniel. And then it just kind of declines, sometimes slowly, sometimes quickly. And now here with Gideon, we're actually going to see in the life of one judge, his circumstances change from good to bad. So I want to show you this. Let's quickly look here in chapter 8. So this is after the defeat of the gigantic Midianite army. And it says in verse 1, then the men of Ephraim, remember that, the men of Ephraim said to him, what is this you've done to us not to call us when you went to fight against Midian? And they accused him fiercely. And he said to them, what have I done now in comparison with you? Is not the gleaning of the grapes of Ephraim better than the grape harvest of Abiezer? You're way better than I am. Verse 3, God has given into your hands the princes of Midian, Oreb and Zeeb. What have I been able to do in comparison with you? Then their anger against them subsided. So Gideon's having to sort of play politician here to calm the tribe of Ephraim down. We'll come back to that in just a moment. Here's what I want you to notice happens next. It says in verse 4 that Gideon came to the Jordan and crossed over. He and the 300 men who were with him, exhausted yet pursuing. So he's pursuing these kings of the armies of the Midianites. And it says in verse 5, so he said to the men of Succoth, please give loaves of bread to the people who follow me. They are exhausted. And hopefully you can see on this map, these locations that are going to be mentioned are just on the eastern side of the Dead Sea. But notice that the officials say in verse 6, are the hands of Zeba and Zalmunna already in your hand that we should give bread to your army? We don't want to help you. We don't know what's going to happen. Things are still uncertain. And so what does Gideon say he's going to do then once he chases down these kings? I'm going to come back and... This sounds like my granddad. This pops warning. If you don't straighten up, I'm going to go get a switch. Or I'm going to send you to go get a switch. Except this is way worse. He says, I will flail your flesh with the thorns of the wilderness and with briars. What I want you to notice here is that Gideon is pursuing these kings and at the same time threatening to punish his own people. He goes from there in verse 8 to Penuel. The same kind of exchange happens. And in verse 9, what does he say he's going to do to the people of Penuel? Yeah, I'm going to come tear down your tower. Now, you might think, boy, this Gideon, he is really zealous to pursue these enemies of the people of God and fight with righteous fervor. Now, let me show you why he's chasing them down. It says in verse 18, when he catches these two kings, where are the men whom you killed at Tabor? And they answered, as you are, so they were. Every one of them resembled the son of a king. And in verse 19, what do we learn about them? They were his brothers. So now you understand why he is so intent on pursuing these men. He is pursuing revenge for the deaths of his own brothers. And in the course of this runs afoul of people in Israel in these cities who don't want to help. And you will also notice that he did exactly what he said we would do in verse 16. He took the elders of the city, took the thorns of the wilderness and briars, and with them taught the men of Succoth a lesson. And he broke down the tower of Penuel and killed the men of the city. So here is Gideon killing Israelites in the course of his pursuit of revenge. Now then, in verse 23, Gideon sounds like he's saying the right thing when he says, when the men of Israel offer him kingship, I will not rule over you, but my son will not rule over you. The Lord will rule over you. This sounds great, doesn't it? Except he has a son, and he names the son Abimelech. Abi, like Abba, father. So my father, and Melech means king. So the guy who just said, oh, I don't want to be king, he names his son, dad's the king. That's one problem. Here's another thing. In verses 21 and 26, he amasses a great treasure from the plunder that is taken in battle. If you skip to the last point, in verse 30, he has 70 sons, for he had many wives. He's acquiring lots of money and treasure. He has a big harem now. And if you remember the book of Deuteronomy, there are warnings in Deuteronomy about the days when Israel would have a king. Guess what some of the things are? Just guess. Take a wild guess what some of the things are that the book of Deuteronomy specifically says, hey, if you're a king, don't do this. Acquire lots of treasure and marry lots of women. So what I want you to see here is that these details given, particularly in the context of Israel's history, not only the warnings in the past, but incidentally, what future king does this remind you of? Amasses treasure and gathers a bunch of wives. Solomon. And how did that work out? Not good. So what this means is then we have to go from the, like I'm calling it, the Bible storybook view of Gideon, which is just all good and all positive, to realizing that in Gideon you're actually seeing the same kind of transition and change happen on a personal level that is happening on a national level as well. One other thing to notice about him, notice that it says that he gathers up all of the gold that they've taken in plunder and ornaments and so forth by the kings of Midian in verse 26. And in verse 27, what does he make of this? An ephod. This is a part of, the only other time we really read about the ephod so far is in the clothing of the high priest. The high priest has an ephod. So now Gideon has taken something that is treasure, gold, plunder, you might say, from battle. He's taking treasure and plunder and turned it into a religious artifact that ends up having what impact on the nation? Notice what it says in chapter 8 and verse 27. All Israel did what? They whored after it. They committed spiritual adultery. Does that remind you anything, taking plunder from other nations and creating a religious artifact that causes the people to stray into idolatry? Yeah, it's the golden calf all over again. So when you read the story of Gideon with all of these echoes from other parts of the story of Israel in mind, you realize that this is a negative portrayal. One other thing I'll just point out to you, remember that in this, the sequence of things that happened, we call it the cycle. So Israel sins, God raises up an oppressor, Israel cries out, God raises up a judge. The fifth and last part of that cycle is the land had rest. This is the last time in the book of Judges we will be told that. So we're just in chapter 8. There's 13 more chapters to go. That kind of gives you an idea of where things are headed just simply by realizing that 8:28 is the last time we have a statement that says the land has rest. Okay? So the good, the bad, that's kind of the move that's happening here in the course of Judges. Any questions or comments up through the end of the Gideon story here in chapter 8? All right, so remember I told you when I was a kid I had to drill and learn these names. Othniel, Ehud, Shamgar, Deborah, Gideon, Abimelech, Tola, Jared, Jephthah, Ibzan, Elon, Samson, Eli, and Samuel. Some of you are nodding your head. You were tortured with the same memory lists as well. But then remember I told you one of those names doesn't belong, and it's the guy who's next. It's his son, Abimelech. is not a judge that God raises up. So now you have to go Othniel, Ehud, Shamgar, Deborah, Gideon, Tola, Jared, Jephthah, Ibzan, Elon, Samson, Eli, and Samuel. So now let's look at the story of Abimelech. Let's first of all set the stage. Verse 33, as soon as Gideon died, the people of Israel turned again and whored after Baals and made Baal-berit their god. And the people of Israel did not remember the Lord their God who had delivered them from the hand of all their enemies. Now, I would suggest to you that this means that Israel's apostasy is getting worse. If I say that to you, could you say back to me, okay, Shane, I think I know what you mean by that. In what sense is Israel's apostasy getting worse? So they had the ephod, which became like an idol to them, but they were still using it in the pretext of serving the Lord. How have things now gotten worse? Yeah, now it's not even the Lord. Now it's the Baals that they are serving. And we already knew from chapter 2 in the preview that this was going to happen. Now it's being spelled out to us. And so then, chapter 9 and verse 1. Now Abimelech, the son of Jerubbaal, remember that's the alternate form of the name of Gideon, that's his nickname, went to Shechem to his mother's relatives and said to them and to the whole clan of his mother's family, say in the ears of all the leaders of Shechem, which is better for you, that all 70 of the sons of Jerubbaal rule over you, or that one rule over you? Remember also that I am your bone and your flesh. So this is the ultimate argument of the superiority of a monarchy over democracy. Democracy's messy. Hard to get things done. 70 different opinions. It'd just be simpler. We just streamline things. Let's just eliminate the middleman and just make me your king. Now this shows us then that Abimelech is doing what Gideon did, but only worse. Gideon says, I don't want to be king, but does everything in the world to act like one. Abimelech follows in his father's footsteps, but as is the cycle of this book, just goes even one step worse because now he openly is campaigning to be the king. And so verse 4 says, they gave him 70 pieces of silver. Oh, I'm sorry, I skipped verse 3. They say, yeah, we'll do it. We're with you. They gave him 70 pieces of silver out of the house of Baal-berit, with which Abimelech hired worthless and reckless fellows who followed him. And then notice, what does he do in verse 5? Yeah, he massacres his brothers, has them all executed on the same stone. Only one survives, which is Jotham. This is very similar to what is going to happen later in Israelite history when the wicked queen Athaliah tries to take over. All right, notice also then that like his father, Abimelech attacks his own people. We have a couple of stories that illustrate this. Verse 22 says, Abimelech ruled over Israel 3 years, and God sent an evil spirit between Abimelech and the leaders of Shechem. And so they deal treacherously as a punishment for what he had done. And so you have this conflict that takes place between Abimelech and the people of Shechem. The next few verses, like verses 34 through 45, describe the war between Abimelech and the people of Shechem. You might notice, incidentally, for example, in verse 43, that at one point to set an ambush, he divides his troops into how many companies? Remind you of anything? In the details of the story of Gideon that we skipped, but I'm hoping most of us remember, Judges chapter 7, that's very similar to the strategy of what Gideon did when he was surrounding the Midianites. Notice that it says in verse 45, Abimelech fought against the city all that day, captured the city, killed the people who were in it, razed, R-A-Z-E-D, the city. What does that mean? Yeah, completely tore it down, and then sowed it with salt. Now, what does that sound like? Completely, utterly destroying a city. Sounds like Sodom and Gomorrah, and it also sounds like the conquest. Except who was doing it to whom? That's supposed to be what Israel did to Canaanite cities like Jericho or Ai or Hazor. Here it's an Israelite doing it to his own cities. which is all part of this pattern of Israel becoming Canaan, thing that not even treating one another like Canaanites. Some of these people escape into a tower, like, you know, even in the medieval period, you have the city keep where you could go as sort of a last stand. And so Abimelech says, hey, go cut the brush down, follow me. And so it says in verse 49, every one of the people cut down his bundle and following Abimelech, put it against the stronghold, set the stronghold on fire. That's another detail that is reminiscent of the conquest when some of the cities like Jericho were burned down. Then he goes and makes war against Thebes in verse 50. So attacking his own people like his father, but notice in an even more ruthless way than his father did. And then, of course, this is the famous story where it says in verse 53, a certain woman threw an upper millstone on Abimelech's head. So you know how a millstone works. You have the lower millstone, and it has sort of a cutout in it where you will put the grain or whatever. And then there's the upper millstone that wedges in it, and you turn it around, either an animal, if it's a big one, or a person. So she takes the upper millstone and chucks it and smashes him in the head. And so he realizes he's mortally wounded. I'm sorry, I shouldn't laugh. But it sure enough comes across like, I don't want people to think a woman killed me, so here, you do it. So he tells his armor bearer to kill him and said he's embarrassed about being killed by a woman. And so it says that he died. Everybody goes home, and God returns on him what he did in killing his 70 brothers. Now, you will notice some things glaringly absent from this story. At no point does it say that God raised up anybody to help. And at no point does it say the land has rest, which is indicating the spiritual deterioration that is taking place here. One other thing I want to notice with you, is this the first story involving a woman causing a mortal wound to the head of someone in the book of Judges? No. So we remember the story of Gideon and Barak, and then when Sisera the general flees and goes into the tent of Heber the Kenite, that his wife Jael takes the tent peg and smashes it through his head. I almost showed you a picture. I have a friend who was an art major, and for one of her projects, she wanted to do something where to show the power of a woman to kill this brutal dictator. But instead of a tent peg, she made this like stiletto heel that was super long. And she wanted to show it piercing through the head of an evil tyrant, but she needed a model. And so I got to be, I'll post this on social media, I got to be the model of Sisera. So I had to sit there, and I'm like severely claustrophobic anyway. And so I am encased in this plastic stuff, and I had a little straw that I had to breathe through. And it was a close fought thing. But anyway, I thought I'd pulled off being a despotic tyrant full of evil pretty well. And my young apprentice over there is certainly agreeing with that. So anyway, makes me think of that story. Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm wildly distracted here thinking about that. So here's the reason I'm bringing it up. Two stories in the book of Judges. Now then, you are smart Bible students, and you know if there's a detail like that that's repeated, it makes you wonder, are there other things repeated like this in the book of Judges? So I want to show you Maria's chart, and the reason it's so cool, not only does it visualize the spiraling downward cycle of Judges, I don't know how well this shows up from your seat, but can you all read the names? Can you see them? At least maybe partway back. You may also see that these names are color-coded, and they're color-coded in sets of pairs. And what I want you to notice is that that Deborah and Barak are the same color as Abimelech plus the next two minor judges, Tola and Jer. So think about it. In the story of Deborah and Barak, you have an account where a woman delivers a mortal wound to the head of an evil man. Well, now, in the story of Abimelech, you have an account where a woman delivers a mortal wound in the head of an evil man. So the way this is constructed by the color coding is to show you that not only do you have this going on, you also have parallels that are taking place, and that's what the purpose of the color coding is. Now, I just realized, those of you who are using your notes that I'm sending out, I put them in black and white. This actually has no help for you then, does it? So maybe I need to create, maybe I need to send out this chart in color form so you all can see, but I'll try to point some of these things as we go through here. All right, obviously though, the good, the bad, the ugly. So we're moving quickly from bad to ugly stage as you see this kind of civil war taking place, Israelite versus Israelite in the book of Judges, and it's going to get much worse. Let me pause here, though, into chapter 9. Any questions or comments before we move on? I really appreciate you all hanging there because you know we've got to get through a lot of stuff each class, so thank you so much. Yeah, Ryan. Ryan, you ask a really good question, and Ralph, actually, we talked about this on the phone this past week before he taught Wednesday night, because he didn't know if it would come up or not. Ryan asked the question, aside from the fact that occasionally the text will say that God raised up a judge, is there any indication of some kind of communication between God and the person that God raises up? Did that question come up Wednesday night, perchance? Ralph thought it might. So he did a really good job of anticipating a potential question. Ralph asked me, were these people prophets in any sense? Here's what we can say. Some of these people God raised up in the same way that he raised up Moses. You can say deliberately raising up, and not only that, empowering. The phrase to look for is the Spirit of the Lord came upon whoever. Some people, though, are used by God in the same way that Pharaoh was used by God. Not in the sense that God is, you know, raising them up to give them supernatural powers, but using their evil actions as a way to carry out judgment. I think Abimelech would obviously fall into that pattern. So I would say, Ryan, the only thing we can look for is look for any references to the Spirit of the Lord coming upon someone. And that doesn't necessarily mean like communication, but it would involve like empowerment, if that makes sense. Okay? Yeah, Pat.
Like for the judges, they were judges over localized areas, not the entire nation of Israel. So when this one group decided to call Baal, whatever, look at just that region, it didn't necessarily mean the entire area.
Yes, Pat is raising a great question, which allows me to segue to this map right here. So it's important to remember, as Pat suggested, that any of these particular judges doesn't necessarily judge all of the nation at one time. There is some local, in fact, almost all of the judges, as you've seen, there are place names that are mentioned that tells you kind of where they were and where they operated. And in fact, as we're going to see here in a second, there seems to be evidence some of them were working simultaneously. Well, one guy's down here, another guy may be up there. And so Pat's point is well taken. It doesn't necessarily mean then, when you see examples of apostasy falling away from the faith, that it swept the entire length and breadth of the nation of Israel. There could have been pockets of righteousness. We also should remember that the next book of the Bible takes place during the time of the judges, which is the book of Ruth, and there are some clear exceptions to apostasy there in that book. Okay? Yeah, that's a great question. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, Jackson's making the point that you clearly see here that all of those warnings in Deuteronomy and Joshua's warnings about remembering the law and parents be sure to teach your children about the works of God and the word of God, those were serious Because when that does not happen, it doesn't take long at all for there to be just an absolute meltdown spiritually of the people. Just like for us as a church. That's why it's just so urgent that we all take that seriously. All right, so let's move on ahead here. Chapter 10, we're going to skip the minor judges of Tola and Jareb just because we've got to hit some highlights here. If you look in chapter 10 and verse 6, we have a sort of a summary of what's happening. Chapter 10, verse 6 says, "The people of Israel again did what was evil in the sight of the Lord and served the Baals and the Ashtaroth." And notice the geographical mentions here. The gods of Syria, which is up to the north. The gods of Sidon, you might remember from doing your map work. That's one of the northern coastal cities. The gods of Moab. Moab is down here on the Transjordan side, on the extreme south. The gods of the Ammonites, that's sort of in the middle section of the Transjordan. The gods of the Philistines. So when you look at this map and you see where these places are, it's kind of like, oh, we're surrounded. So this is not good. Influence is coming from all around. To Pat's point, if you look at verse 7, "So the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel, and he sold them into the hand of the Philistines and into the hand of the Ammonites." And that previews really the rest of the stories of the judges. Who is going to fight with the Philistines and interact? Not always fight, but interact with the Philistines. Samson. And the story of Jephthah is going to talk about the wars that take place with the Ammonites. So that gives us a little transitional note here. So here is, you know, here's our big picture map of Israel. So now we are going to zoom in on the area around the Dead Sea and the Transjordan, or the eastern side of the Dead Sea, which is going to focus then on the conflict that takes place with the Ammonites. But to Pat's point, I think that verse gives us an idea of that probably at the same time Samson is involved with the Philistines over on the extreme west, southwest part of Israel, that Jephthah is dealing with the Ammonites over here on the eastern side. Jephthah is not the only judge who deals with threats over here on the eastern side of the Jordan River. Remember that Ehud, who fights with Eglon, you might notice that I made sure I was not here to teach that class about Ehud and Eglon. Do you remember Eglon is king of what region? Well, you take a guess. He's king of Moab. So just like Ehud dealt with a threat over on the eastern side of the Jordan River, so does Jephthah. So if you go back and look at that chart, you'll never guess who's paired off with each other then. Right? So let's take a look here at this story of Jephthah. Verse 1, chapter 11. Jephthah, the Gileadite, that's one of the regions, you know, over here. You can see it, maybe. You can see Gilead mentions like a word search here. So it's going vertically this way, right in the middle of the screen. Was a mighty warrior. He was the son of a prostitute. So this is a man who is not certainly in high standing in society. He's driven from his father's house, it says in verse 2. Verse 3 says, "Jephthah fled from his brothers and lived in the land of Tob." And when you're a reject, guess who the only other people are you can hang out with? Fellow rejects. So he hangs out with worthless fellows that gather around him. So this is kind of a gang, if you want to think about it like that. And it says in verse 4, "After a time the Ammonites made war against Israel." And now guess who the Gileadites need to help them? They need Jephthah. And so in verse 6, they said to Jephthah, "Come and be our leader that we may fight against the Ammonites." And he basically says, "Well, wait a minute. You just kicked me out of here. Now all of a sudden you need me?" And so he says in verse 9, "If you bring me home again to fight against the Ammonites and the Lord gives them over to me, I will be your head." And so they swear that they will do this. And so then in verse 12, you have this really interesting exchange that takes place that commentaries say this is like, like right now there are talks going on between Russia and the Ukraine, that this whole account here sounds very much like the disputations that would take place in ancient treaty making, trying to negotiate and mediate a dispute between nations. So it's a dispute over territory on the eastern side of the Jordan River. What I want you to notice, though, is the way Jephthah argues that, hey, this land belongs to us. It doesn't belong to you. He says in verse 23, so then the Lord, the God of Israel, dispossessed the Amorites from before his people Israel, and are you to take possession of them? So I'm counting on the fact that those of you who were in class last quarter will remember that the conquest begins when Israel comes up out of the land of the wilderness and circles up to the eastern side of the Jordan River. In other words, this is territory that was among the first pieces of territory conquered. Sihon and Og, those guys. This is like their territory here. So Jephthah says, hey, God gave us this land, but I want you to notice verse 24. Will you not possess what Chemosh, your God, gives you to possess? And all that the Lord our God has dispossessed before us, we will possess. Now, I am not a fan of something that's done a lot in popular culture where you do like a revisionist take on someone. Like, to be honest, even Wicked, you all have seen that show. I kind of liked it, but there's also a part of me that does not like, well, actually, the bad guys are the good guys and the good guys are the bad guys. So I'm not trying to read the book through like these super suspicious lenses that just puts the worst twist on everything possible. But I'm going to do that here. But there's something that Jephthah says in verse 24 that I think should raise some significant red flags. And I want to know, do you see what it is? That's exactly right. He's acknowledging that Chemosh is a god and that, hey, your God gives you your land, our God gives us our land. Well, guess what? God gives everybody their land. The Bible's emphatic about this. Deuteronomy 32 specifically says God's giving the nations their land. In fact, according to the sons of Israel. So it is troubling that Jephthah apparently seems to believe in other gods. Now, maybe he was just talking like from their point of view, and he doesn't really mean this. So I'll grant you that is a possibility, but it is certainly disturbing. Of course, the other thing that is so disturbing about the Jephthah story is the possible, and I will say possible, offering of his daughter. So you know the story. Jephthah, the Ammonites do not want to negotiate. There's just going to be war. And so the text tells, by the way, verse 29, Ryan, to answer your question, the Spirit of the Lord was upon Jephthah. Verse 30, he makes a vow. And what is the vow? First thing come out of my house, sacrifice to the Lord, is a burnt offering. Now, who knows what he had in mind? I don't. We do know that the way ancient houses were constructed, part of the house actually had stable area. He may have thought it was going to be an animal. But he had to know it was at least a possibility that it could be a person. And sure enough, it's his daughter, his only child, a virgin daughter that comes out. Now, I will tell you that for the longest time, I just could not accept the possibility that when verse 39 says that he did with her according to his vow that he made, that it meant he offered her as a child sacrifice. Because the law of Moses is emphatic and clear. In fact, Israel really, in distinction from all the nations, does not practice child sacrifice. But of course, that is assuming something. What is that assuming? That he's following the law. Exactly. If in fact, when he said to the Ammonites, hey, your God gives you your land, our God gives ours, and really meant it, it wasn't just propaganda, but he really meant that, then that means he obviously is not following the law on the most fundamental level. Not only that, the law of Moses was very clear in Leviticus 27, if you made a rash vow, you can pay it off. You do not have to follow through. He obviously doesn't know that. So what I would say to you is, I can't say for sure. I do think, as much as it troubles me to say this, that the most straightforward reading of what the text is saying is that he offered her. But we just need to remember Not everything that these people do in the book of Judges is the right thing to do. A lot of them make terrible mistakes. Abimelech, as we're going to see with Samson. And so if the issue is, well, how could God have used them? Well, God uses a lot of people who do a lot of wicked things because he's going to bring about his purposes through that. And if you accept the notion of this downward spiral as describing the spiritual degeneration of the nation and the people, then I think that very much opens the possibility that the very worst thing happened. But here is the thing. Unfortunately, in Judges, this is not even close to the worst thing that's going to happen because things are going to get so terrible. So who knows? I will hold it still as an open question. Frankly, my biases from many years of thinking otherwise hold me back, and maybe they're holding me back from acknowledging what some would say the text just is plainly saying. But we at least need to think that that's a possibility that happened that shows us how imperfect the people are that God is working, through. Dave, I'm so sorry. You had your hand up a minute ago.
What it shows to me is that, like the Spiderman pointed out earlier, God has come from God Most High to one amongst peers in the view of the Israelites. And that is where the problems start. We have that problem in our own society today.
Yeah.
God is no longer Most High, he is one amongst peers. And that's where the degeneration begins. You lose that sight. I think that's clear here. Jephthah doesn't see God as Most High, only obey what he does. He says, I've made a vow, I have to fulfill that vow, regardless of what the law says, because that's what people expect.
Right, yeah. No, I think everybody probably heard Dave, and I think that point is very well taken. John, did somebody have their hand up in through here? I thought I saw one go up. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, Willie.
I'm hard to see.
You're like me. Everybody see me behind this music stand? It's built just like me. So we're all good here. All right. Yeah, go ahead.
Can you just elaborate a little bit on this vow?
Yeah.
What it entails?
Sure. That's a really good. Willie's asking about the vow. We do know, if you just do a simple Bible word search, the word vow comes up a lot in the Bible, particularly in the book of Psalms, and it was a way for a person to express their deep reliance on God and their faith in God, that if God answered a prayer, they would offer X, Y, or Z. So that's what a vow is. All right, now, one other thing I want to talk about, and I think we'll have just enough time to get it done. So do you remember, back in the story of Gideon, who complained, hey, you didn't call us out to let us be a part of the battle. Who was it that complained? Tribe of Ephraim. Notice chapter 12 and verse 1. The men of Ephraim were called to arms, and they crossed to Zaphon and said to Jephthah, why did you cross over to fight against the Ammonites and didn't call us to go with you? We will burn your house over you with fire. Jephthah said to them, I and my people had a great dispute with the Ammonites, and when I called you, you didn't save me from their hand. So I took my life in my own hands. And what ends up happening is this time, because things are getting worse, peace isn't made. This time there's just actually open war between the tribe of Ephraim and Jephthah and his crew. And this is the famous story where, to determine who is an Ephraimite and who is not, in verse 6 they said, then say Shibboleth. And when he said Sibboleth, for he couldn't pronounce it right, they seized him and slaughtered him. Apparently the Ephraimites had a speech limitation. They could not say the sh sound. They could only say the s sound. So now we have open warfare between Ephraim and everybody else. Now, a good Bible student is going to ask this question. Why are the Ephraimites causing all these problems? And why does the text keep telling us that? When the nation of Israel splits, and King Rehoboam leads the tribes to the north away, would you like to guess what tribe Jeroboam was from? That is an understanding and explanation of why the text is giving us a preview of what's going to come in the future. Whew. All right, we made it. We got through here. All right, Lord willing, on Wednesday night, we'll look at the Samson narrative.